Welcome back to the second half of The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. In the United States, we have the right to travel. Well, maybe not. Well, we have the right to travel within the nation's borders. Well, maybe not so much. Well, at least not air travel, with requirements to show your ID to the airport to board a plane and that infamous no-fly list, which is now up to about 20,000 names. The right to travel isn't what it used to be. How did it get eroded? How did it become a memory of life in a simpler age? The book Mrs. Shipley's Ghost, The Right to Travel, The Terrorist Watch List, takes a look at this puzzle, and the author joins us on the phone, Jeffrey Kahn. Jeffrey, welcome to The Source.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be here.
So let me ask you, Mr. Kahn, about Mrs. Shipley, the title character in your book, fascinating character. Tell us about her.
Well, the more you learn about her, the more modern she seems, even though she never used a computer, and I doubt she ever flew on an airplane. She was born in 1885, and when she was in her early 30s, she started working at the State Department, which was unusual for a woman, but even more unusual for a woman at that time. She ascended like a rocket, and by the time she was in her early 40s, in 1928, she was the head of the State Department's Passport Office, an office that she directed until her retirement in 1955.
The segment, when you talk about her and the Passport Office, particularly in the World War II and the post-war era, it reminds me so much of the movie, Orson Welles' film, The Third Man, and all of that stuff about, you know, papers and who is from what country and forged documents and stuff.
Right. Well, I don't know if you can hear the famous zither music from that movie all throughout my book, but it resonates, and that's a good analogy. She used the best, most modern technology of her day, which was analog. There were no computers then, and that meant a lot of paper. And the passport, which was slowly evolving into a license for travel from what it used to be, which was just a convenience so that you didn't have to show papers and visas from different organizations at every border. She used that to restrict travel of people that she thought and the United States Congress thought were extremely dangerous, people that became even more dangerous in her mind once nuclear weapons were available.
Yeah, she became very much the person who decided who got to travel and who didn't, which, of course, I thought was a great line in the book when we talk. You write about how when she finally retires after 47 years in government, what she does is that she takes a European vacation.
And nobody doubted that she would get a passport very, very quickly. She was beloved in Washington, D.C., especially on the Hill, because congressmen and senators knew that the best way for them to look like they were doing great work for their constituents was to be able to expedite their travel. And if somebody needed to quickly go to Europe or go on a business trip, a quick call to Mrs. Shipley could help untangle tremendous red tape.
And she certainly seems like a formidable person on the cover photo of your book. Now, let's fast forward to today. Here we have this no-fly list and a lot of restrictions on travel. It seems like that Mrs. Shipley sort of started the movement where the government became more and more involved in who got the travel, who was denied the ability to travel.
You know, I chose Mrs. Shipley not only because she was formidable, but because she was exceptionally good at her job. She was very dedicated. She was an intelligent civil servant and no doubt a patriot. And the same thing can be said about the men and women in our government today and at the time of September 11th. Everybody I talked to make this book, to interview both current and former officials, struck me as extremely responsible, very dedicated people. My disagreement and the reason for writing this book is a policy disagreement. I think that although in their zeal to protect us, they've created something that Mrs. Shipley would really marvel at, like Mrs. Shipley, they've gone too far in trying to balance security against our liberties. And when the nation looked objectively at Mrs. Shipley's system, as the Cold War began to wane and more cases rose up through the courts, we dismantled that system. And I think that we ought to learn from that history and, if not dismantle, radically change the no-fly list system.
Let me ask our callers to call in if they have a question, if they have an experience being on the no-fly list. The number is 614-8980. If they think that they feel secure in knowing that the government has a no-fly list and they think that nothing should change, or if they want to see some reform in this area, 614-8980. Do we have a right to travel in the United States? Because it's not in the Constitution.
It's not in the text of the Constitution, but one of the things that I try to teach our students here at Southern Methodist University's law school is that there's a lot more to reading the Constitution than just the bare words on the page. We look at the history of those words. We look at their context. We look at the structure of the document as a whole. And when those things are put together along with the case law of the Supreme Court interpreting that document, it's clear that we do have a fundamental right to travel. It's even stronger domestically than it is internationally. The question is, what exactly does that mean, and to what extent can it be restricted before that infringement leads to a violation of that right that the government cannot commit?
So the freedom of movement under United States law is governed primarily by the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which states the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states.
Well, there have been cases that have focused on the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4 of the Constitution. There have also been cases focusing on, you'll be surprised to hear, the Commerce Clause, and cases that have focused on the fact that we have a federal form of government that would be eroded if individual states could throw up travel restrictions as if they were independent sovereignties. But there have also been cases that have focused on the Due Process Clause, on what liberty means, and one aspect of liberty, according to the Supreme Court, is the freedom of movement. Where it gets a little more complicated is how that translates via technology. The United States government would argue that they're not infringing your right to travel at all. You have the right to travel anywhere you like. You just can't travel by plane without the express permission of the government.
And not being able to travel by plane, that's quite a hardship, especially for if you're a business person. It's hard for you to earn a living if you can't get on an airplane.
Well, in 2010, 16% of business travel was by airplane. 55 million people traveled by plane that year in and out of American airports. That's as if you emptied the city of Philadelphia and put them on planes every day for a year over and over and over again. You still wouldn't fill up all of the seats. Make an analogy to freedom of speech. Certainly we wouldn't say, well, of course you've got the freedom of speech, you just can't use the phone. Why don't you use quill and paper the way the founders did? I think we'd all agree that translating the text and spirit of the Constitution through our modern technology in that way would really not comport with the liberty that that document's supposed to enshrine.
And have there been challenges about what's happening with the no-fly list and all these other issues? I know the ACLU recently filed a suit about that.
Yes, and there have been several challenges. They're at different stages. They're all over the country. Typically, what has happened is someone has traveled abroad before they were put on the no-fly list, and then found, to their dismay, that they couldn't get home again.
Wow.
Imagine it, a United States citizen that can't get home again.
Okay,
and
so they're like,
them have,
so they're stuck out there. We're going to continue that idea, talk more about the no-fly list, about our right to travel in the United States. We want to hear from callers. The number is 614-8980. We're talking about the book Mrs. Shipley's Ghost, The Right to Travel and the Terrorist Watch List. The author is Jeffrey Kahn. He's on the line. This is The Source on KSTX. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The right to travel, get on an airplane, fly wherever you want to go, inside the United States, anywhere in the world. Do you actually have that right? Well, apparently the federal government has a say-so in whether or not you can board that airplane and if you've got to find some other means to get where you want to go. It's a theme that's explored in the book Mrs. Shipley's Ghost, The Right to Travel and the Terrorist Watch List. The author of the book is on the phone joining us, Jeffrey Kahn. Jeffrey's also an associate professor of law at Southern Methodist University. University. So, Jeffrey Kahn, you're saying that I know that the ACLU is challenging the federal government about this no-fly list, mainly because there is so many questions about it, and once you're on it, how do you get off it?
The most recent case, or at least the most recent action in one of these cases, has been occurring up in Portland, Oregon. The case is called Latif versus Holder, and they had an oral argument before a federal judge there in Portland at the end of June to decide whether the case could go to trial. And what's interesting about these cases is this case, along with several others, involved plaintiffs who've traveled abroad. Then they were placed on the no-fly list, or suspect they were, because the government won't tell them definitely, and couldn't get back home again. Now, the government would contest that view and say they could have taken a boat, but the problem is that, although this isn't known to very many people, there's also a maritime watch list, too.
A maritime watch list. And so, but nothing for Greyhound?
Not yet. Not yet, but you can see the logic of this system. Why wouldn't you have a maritime watch list when the same terror could be accomplished by evil-minded people with regard to cruise ships or oil tankers? You would have the same anxieties as you would with an airplane. And that's the danger of these lists. When they are kept far from judicial review, when they are decisions about human beings, United States citizens and their lives made in secret, even by well-meaning officials, the temptation to expand the list is inevitable. Why not have a list for sporting events? Why not have a list for government licenses involving, say, hazardous materials or individuals who are going to work at important facilities like electrical plants or nuclear power stations? You would want one of those lists. And had 9/11 involved an attack on a railway, as happened in Europe a few years after, we would have a no-train list, too.
Now, that's kind of like the Dick Cheney doctrine, which is if there's a 1% chance that a person's a terrorist, they have to be treated as if it was a 100% chance.
Well, after 9/11, the White House was understandably very involved in this. And what they realized as they looked about was there wasn't a ready-to-use system out there of stopping individuals from getting on these planes once you determine that they're dangerous. And the reason for that was twofold. One, there were many different sources of information coming to many different agencies in the federal government, and not everybody knew what everybody else knew. So the FBI had its list, the State Department had its list, the intelligence community had other lists. There needed to be a consolidated system.
All right, I want to try and get to this caller here. He doesn't want to give his name, but this person says they are on the no-fly list. So, caller, you're on the air. Tell us about your experience.
Yeah, I've been on the no-fly list since 9/11, and for months I needed to fly, so I was being delayed each time, and I finally was able to get somebody to give me some reasoning behind it, because I never had anything to do with that. And a woman at one of the ticket desks finally told me that there was an individual that had my same birth date, but the year was off by one, had my same name, first and last name, which is Middle Eastern name, and the birth date was just off by a year. So I, I'm currently subject to the same type of scrutiny, and I mailed in the required documents to have my name removed, but that wasn't the case. They just sent me a federal form that I have to take with me every time that I check in. So it's like I don't see that there's much of an advantage. I guess my main question would be is who has access to that list, and how would that affect an individual that is on the list? Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for calling in, and thanks for sharing your story. So Jeffrey Kahn, author of Mrs. Shipley's Ghost, The Right to Travel, and The Terrorist Watch List, what do you think about when you hear a story like that?
Well, two things come to mind. First of all, one of the problems is knowing what list you're on. If the caller's travel was delayed each time he tried to travel, but nevertheless he ultimately, after much frustration, could board a plane, he's not on the no-fly list. But he might be on something called the selectee list, which is a list of individuals who are designated for heightened scrutiny when they pass through a sanitized part of the airport. The second issue that it raises is redress. And when our caller described his efforts to send in the necessary documents, he might have meant sending them in to the Department of Homeland Security, which is the department in which the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, resides. They're the ones who work the list and use the list, but they're not the ones who create the list. The list is created by the Terrorist Screening Center at the FBI. And one of the complaints in federal litigation now is seeking redress from the TSA, which is the only available system that the government has created, isn't good enough because it doesn't get to the source of the composition of the list.
And one comment we had online is, who has access to that list?
Well, the Terrorist Screening Center creates something called the Terrorist Screening Database, which is a consolidated database of all of the terrorist-related information known to the federal government. And from that large database, the TSDB, it creates sublists, specialized lists like the no-fly list or the selectee list or other lists that are sent to what the TSC calls its customers, like the TSA. So who has access to the list is a hard question to answer because there are many different lists composed from many different agencies.
And what does it take to be put on the list? Can I just call in on my neighbor and just say Joe Schmo is you know, not suitable for flight, and they'll put him on the list?
Well, the actual criteria for inclusion on the no-fly list are secret. They're not publicly known. But we have been told what some of the standards are for assessing those criteria, and the standards are remarkably low. It's not probable cause, which is a standard used in criminal law, but something lower called reasonable suspicion. If the government official has reasonable suspicion based on articulable facts that the criteria have been met, you can be put on one of these lists. What those criteria are and how that reasonable suspicion standard actually is used person to person is very hard to determine. But one thing is clear. When lots of different analysts are assigned discrete tasks like checking this information, nobody has an incentive to err on the side of caution. And that incentive is even less when those officials are anonymous and shielded from redress by the problems of litigation that these court cases are trying to resolve.
So, are we talking about bureaucrats who are in charge of this? Is there anything like a FISA court? And I'm not so confident in the activities of the FISA court, but at least it's a court.
Well, there is a system of redress. The letter that your first caller received may well have said that this letter he received was final agency action, and he could appeal the agency decision to the United States Court of Appeals. There are various courts of appeals sitting throughout the country. But the problem is that was a system that was held over from the 1970s, and it really wasn't designed for this sort of a system, a very modern system of the no-fly list. It was really designed for decisions by the Federal Aviation Administration for things like license suspensions or other government activity which takes place in the open with known criteria, known facts that everybody can see and contest. And so not one of those Court of Appeals cases has actually come to a decision on the merits, and there are only a handful in the country.
So you mentioned driver's licenses, and is that a license to travel? You have to have a driver's license to drive. If you can't get on a drive, then you're pretty much unable to travel freely, and it's really hard to get on an airplane without one.
Well, there are some pretty important differences between a driver's license and, let's call the no-fly list, a license to fly. Your driver's license is given to you so long as you can pass a test. You know what test you have to pass. You know what criteria you have to meet. And if you are treated unfairly by the Department of Motor Vehicles, you've got a very open system of redress. Try to get your license to fly now. What are the criteria? What's the test? What's the redress? It's a very, very different system, and that's why I think that a driver's license is not going to violate your right to travel, but the no-fly list does.
And there's no prior notice that you are on the no-fly list until you try to fly.
And even then, you're not going to be told, or you're not supposed to be told, what list you're on. Originally, the airlines were charged with operating these lists. They would get them by fax. But the airlines proved to be inconsistent and a little untrustworthy with regard to it, and so the government took it over with a system called Secure Flight. And since that system was operationalized, everybody, when buying a ticket, must provide name, date of birth, and gender to try to avoid some of the problems your first caller identified. That information is sent not just to the airline, but from the airline to the federal government, which vets that information against the no-fly list and other terrorist watch lists. And only if the government sends back its consent would you get the boarding pass that you paid for when you made the reservation.
Real quickly now, is there a chance to roll back this government acquisition of power to curb our freedom of travel?
There is, and I think that this inevitably will take the same route that Mrs. Shipley's system took. It's going to happen like this.
People got to get involved.
People must get involved, and supporting some of these cases is a good way to do it. Whether it happens through the citizenship clause, as I describe, or other parts of the Constitution, I think the no-fly list inevitably has to change.
All right. Jeffrey Kahn, Associate Professor of Law, Southern Methodist University, author of the book Mrs. Shipley's Ghost, A Right to Travel and the Terrorist Watch List. This is The Source on KSTX. Coming up tomorrow on The Source, the housing market has been like a roller coaster. First it was sky high, and then there was that plunge. Now things are on their way back up. How is the housing market in San Antonio? Did we miss our moment to buy? We'll take your calls and emails. Join us for The Source tomorrow afternoon at 3 on KSTX. The Source is made possible through support for the TPR Community Engagement Fund.
Your typical TV show, probably 30 minutes or an hour. What about 13 hours? Binge watching in the Netflix model next time on Marketplace from APM.
You can hear Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on News and Views at 89.1 KSTX.
From the KSTX Community Events Calendar, tomorrow, Arden Courts of San Antonio hosts an Alzheimer's informational session from 6 to 7:30. Saturday from 10 to 1, a Texas Veterans Benefits Fair will be hosted at the Norris Conference Center. And TED San Antonio's application deadline is Monday at noon. Learn more at tedxsanantonio.com/speak. Find details on these events and more at tpr.org. The Community Events Calendar is a public service of KSTX.
This is KSTX, San Antonio. Good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock.